I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Now you're about to hear a broadcast from one of our archived editions, from our series that we call Beyond the Spin, voices from community radio stations from around the United States of America. This is the conversation by Native American journalists from around the country about the Washington football team and the names they use. Hello, this is Mark Steiner, and welcome to Beyond the Spin. This episode of Beyond the Spin, this part of our episode, has to do with something that happened here in Baltimore over the weekend that made me realize that it's time to have this conversation once again. The Baltimore Ravens, which is the football team here out of Baltimore, played the Washington team. And so Washington beat the Ravens. And what ensued at the radio station from which we broadcast is that we heard people using the R word and screaming that they won and wearing these ties with the emblem on it. And we broadcast from a station that is a African-American run public radio station in Baltimore, WEAA. So we began to raise the issue, but, you know, we keep using this word, but I can't use it. It's a racist word. We had this long conversation on Facebook and with each other. So I thought that it was an opportune moment to begin this conversation. And what that means for people. And we are joined here by Suzanne Schoen-Harjo, who is president of the Morningstar Institute, a national Native rights organization, a columnist for Indian Country Today Media Network, a past executive director of the National Congress of American Indians, and a founder of the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C., and former news director of the American Indian Press Association. We're also joined by Mark Trahant, an independent print and broadcast journalist who's joined us many times here on the show. Ellen Storowski is with us. She's a professor in the Department of Sports Management at the Goodwin School of Professional Studies at Drexel University. And Marge Kalama, who's also joined us a number of times here on the show, who is host of the show Talking Drum and Our People in Mother Earth on KWSO in Warm Springs, Oregon. And everyone, welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So, Suzanne, let me just start with you. I know that you actually took the Washington team to court a few years back to make them drop the name. Tell a bit about that story, because I think there's a lot of people who just don't hear it. They hear it, but you just don't get it.
The if I can summarize 17 years of litigation briefly, we eventually lost on a technicality, which said we waited too long to file between the time we had turned 18, each of the plaintiffs, and the time we filed, which was a unique defense in the history of affirmative defenses. And we did not lose, specifically did not lose on the merits. We had a meritorious ruling in our favor from the experts, the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board judges, in 1999. After 7 years of litigation, we won the trademark licenses for the name and logo were canceled and pending appeals. And then we spent the next 10 years defending that agency's, the Patent and Trademark Board's ruling. And we lost before the federal district court judge who overruled the trademark judges. And then while the appeals board did not, the appeals court did not pick up her ruling on the merits and specifically did not, they did agree with her on latches, the technicality. So, and then we did not win court review by the Supreme Court. In the meantime, we had, so our case ended in 2009, and we had organized a young people's lawsuit when we saw the way things were going, who do not have the kind of latches problem that we had, that as identified by the federal district court judge. And so that case was filed in 2006, and it proceeded once our case was ended. And that case has been fully briefed and is awaiting a hearing and a ruling before the Trademark Trial and Appeals Board. So that's the status of litigation. There has been, since 1992, continuous litigation on this subject in the two court cases and that is ongoing. And I should say that during that time, the team owners have changed everything. Three owners have changed. The uniforms have changed. The helmets have changed. The coaches have changed. All the players have changed. The only thing that hasn't changed is this disparaging, despicable name. And if I were one of the owners, I would think that there would be a little karma there involved in the fact that since we filed suit, they have never been back to a Super Bowl. And I would start changing the name fast. Because this year will make a 21st year that they will not have returned to a Super Bowl.
It's changed into the Washington Diplomats or something.
But that's right.
Well, the Washington Gridlocks, that would be a bit.
That's right. Or Wild Hogs. Or you know, everyone has their favorite.
Or the Washington Treaty Breakers. Anyway, so I...
My.
So I'll stop now.
Talk about your dirty words.
So, Ellen, as someone who has been involved in this world of sports management, talk about this from the perspective of the teams themselves, and what kind of conversations you've had. Whether it's the team, all the colleges that have teams that are named after something out of the Native American world, or the Cleveland Indians, or whatever those are. When these discussions happen, what takes place on the team from the team perspective?
Well, you know, Mark, the way I'd like to address that question is really to think about this in terms of how these conversations really teach us about how racism and racialized ways of thinking work. You know, it's a great honor and privilege to be on the program with Suzanne, who's been battling this issue for so many decades and been so eloquent in trying to explain what's going on here. And, you know, whether we look at the situation with the Cleveland Indians or with the narratives and the stories that are told to rationalize this imagery, or whether we're looking at the Washington franchise and the stories that are told about the fact that a racial pejorative is not offensive. In all of these instances, we really have a lesson in how a majority manipulates language in such a way and uses power to back it up in order to achieve a certain goal. And I think that's what's really at stake in terms of these conversations, is that we have a term like the Redskins, which is documentably offensive. And we have all manner of information that tells us that this is something which is just not acceptable and is, you know, by any measure a racist term. And yet, because of the fact that we have people who are in positions of power who can back up that power with money, they're permitted to continue to engage in this racialized way of acting. And I think that what is really at stake here is our shared humanity. And it's the reason why we need to come back to this conversation over and over and over again, because what it also means is that we're continuing to abuse the subject of this conversation, and in this case, quite blatantly, American Indians. So I think this is the reason why people in sport management have to look at it. I think it's the reason why people in education have to look at it. It's the reason why people judges and lawyers need to look at it, because there's a truth-telling component to this that we have to come to grips with.
And Mark Trahan, are you back with us now?
I am.
Oh, good. So, Mark, let me bring you back in this conversation. And one of the things we were talking about, and I think people don't really get or listen to or understand around the country, is what that word means, the Washington R word means, in terms of, you know, when I was talking to folks at the station, I was saying this is tantamount to saying the N word or to any other kind of racial epithet. And people just don't seem to get it, that it's that severe.
Well, and Suzanne has done more work on this than anybody, but definitely it is a, it's a celebration of what would be lynching to the extreme, carrying a bounty to communities, and it would be offensive in any context beyond sport. I want to get back to something that I think is absolute genius that Suzanne did in this whole persevering cause, is removing the trademark protections. And I just don't think you can underestimate how powerful that would be over the long haul, that if you're going to use something despicable like this, that you can't make money from it. And once that happens, it's all going to change. I mean, I view this as inevitable anyway, mm-hmm. but once that one thing is taken out of the equation, no team will keep its name.
So March, I'm curious, in Warm Springs in Oregon, how this plays out where you live.
I live in Warm Springs on a reservation here, and our school, our reservation border school, are called the White Buffaloes. And the White Buffalo is a sacred name to me. And so I tried to teach them about the White Buffalo, and the kids got it. It was the administration that turned away. The children, the high school kids, understood and loved the story. But then when our Dells, they're called Dells Indians, at our prom football game for a whole week, they had a contest, a poster contest, and the winning poster was depicting Indians with their heads cut off, with being drugged by horses and blood all over. And I walked the halls and I looked at it and I said, "Do you see what I see?" And the children did. The young adults seen what I seen, and this is that's it. And I said, "It is." But the administration and the adult population chose that poster as the winning poster for the homecoming.
Hmm.
And for me, I was called a squaw all through high school, and also lived through Estacada Indians posters. And it was enlightening to me that the young people understood my feelings. It was the administration that did not understand what our people were feeling when we looked at those pictures of Indians being massacred, you know, in pictures only, you know. And so I do applaud everybody that is on this station, giving us all hope that one day we won't have to see pictures like that. And in Oregon in 2017, anybody who has those kinds of names will not receive state funding.
Huh. That's good to hear. That's progress. And it's off the progress has to be so slow. And Suzanne, the other week we were talking with Sherman Alexie on this show, and one of the things he talked about was that when it comes to these kind of team names on the country, or the symbols like the Cleveland Indian symbol, which, as I was describing to some people at our station the other day, is equivalent to a black Sambo. It has to be a red Sambo instead of a black Sambo. He said a couple of things. One was that he said there's a lot that has to be done because so many of the players and spectators are people of color, and they're not acting in a way that shows solidarity with another community of color, A. And B, one part of it was talking about because in the Native world in America don't have the congressmen, the numbers of actors who make people come to the movies that have the personas that make a presence known where things couldn't happen like that. I wonder if you could comment on those two things.
Well, he's so right. And that Chief Wahoo, the Red Sambo, is the graphic equivalent of the name of the Washington team. And I want to point out that we've eliminated, we collectively, Native people and our many, many supporters and communities of color and women and everyone who has been, who has backed us and stood beside us since the 60s to eliminate all of these names. We've eliminated across the country almost all of the names that are the same as the Washington team. And of the 3,000 that, over 3,000 that stood in 1970 when the very first so-called Native mascot fell at the University of Oklahoma, Little Red, we have eliminated over two-thirds in American sports. So the good news is that we've already won. We have there's already a societal sea change across the country, and we're down to the last 900 or so of these names. And so we only have one-third to go, and of course, all of the professional names, team names, are included in that. We and how has that happened? Well, it's happened Native child by Native child, Native student by Native student, Native family by Native family, and all of the people they were able to convince or agree to help them. And that has resulted in changes in the school districts throughout Louisville, Kentucky, for example, and the Unified School District in Los Angeles, and Wisconsin. Actions have been taken to eliminate public schools, as was stated earlier, in Oregon, now Washington State, in Wisconsin, and years ago in Minneapolis, in Minnesota. So this is happening place by place, state by state as well, and district by district. But it always comes down to the individual school or the individual team and who is able to mount the greatest campaign. And I must say that there are no original arguments on either side. It's a constant replay of everything that has been said over these many decades. But the good news, and I think it's really good news, is that we have already won this battle, and these names are being consigned to the history books and to the museums where they belong as curiosities.
Whenever this comes up, this discussion comes up in public, and I was reading some online discussions. I saw one that you had several years back, Suzanne, where some really blatantly racist and horrible things were said as you were in this online chat. And I was reading a few more this morning, thinking about today's conversation. And let me just read just one, just so we can respond to it. Because I think this is a kind of commonly held belief when they when they hear the Native American names of teams, and that I think a majority of Americans don't think that it's offensive. And I'll just read this, and we can respond from a person whose name I'm not sure of their name, but it was on one of these chats that I pulled off the web, and I think it's universal in a feeling with numbers of people. It reads, "I mean, seriously, I also think it's racist for the Patriots to depict white people as three-point hat-wearing colonists with muskets, and I think it's racist for the Pittsburgh Pirates to depict white people as sea-bound thieves, and the Los Angeles Kings shouldn't be depicting Europeans as monarchists, and the rank of chief should be eliminated from the army. You know, I'm one-quarter Native American," this person writes, "and I think you should just get a life. I'm so tired of white people," blah, 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 going on. So, but that is, I think, a very commonly held feeling about this.
I want those people who say that and talk that way, they don't live as a pirate. They don't live the life that they depict as that kind of society. We do live as Native American Indians. We still practice our society. That's the difference. We still live what they think is dead. We're still alive. And we still hold honor in our chief. And they earn their way to be a chief. They don't just slap a headdress on and parade around an arena and like that. But we're still a society that is a living society. And it hurts us to see fans painted like Indians when they're not, you know, and they'd have no reason to put the war paint on, you know, unless they really mean it. And that we're a living society. That's the difference.
Well, that's so right. We're not an era, and we're not a profession. Because the cowboys and the pirates, and I mean, these are eras and professions. We're not a profession. We're not an era. We're native peoples. We're living human beings in the modern time as well as part of our ancient cultural continuum. So that's the absolute difference between us and all the other things. And saying that, making that criticism or that critique, which, and I'm sure that person thinks he's awfully original, but we hear that all the time. making that critique is simply acknowledging the racism that exists in the person by not thinking that we're human beings and not allowing that we're still alive and we still continue our customs and traditions. Well, and there are so many wonderful choices and inventive choices of names and mascot. I mean, Baltimore is a great example. I mean, there's something that's a reference to a poet.
Right.
The Raven.
Right,
which
exactly.
Is extraordinary. I mean, I love that.
Right.
In Michigan, there's a team called the Lugnuts. I love that. So why do we have to keep ragging on the human being? I think the human beings need to be taken out of the equation so that there's no mockery of, I mean, it's the other group of fans' job to mock the opposite team's name and colors and everything about it. So the best thing to do is to not depend on them to become polite or decent, but to just remove the human equation from the whole business of mascotting and names of teams.
And Ellen, I want your perspective again in terms of what you teach and work in, how you see the change taking place, and if the change is taking place even on your campuses or campuses around you. Do people wrestle with this at all?
I think that the college and university setting has been wrestling with this from the 1970s to the present, and certainly there has been a progress that has been made in terms of the number of schools that have dropped references to Native Americans. You know, controversially, the NCAA had passed a resolution indicating that schools that had Native American mascots would have to either abandon them if they were going to participate and host NCAA events, or they were going to have to cover over those names on their own uniforms. And since then, some schools, most famously Florida State, has been permitted to maintain that imagery, but a good many schools have since ceased using it. I think that and not only, you know, we are talking about team names, but it is kind of noticeable that the only part of our news coverage that we have, and sports is a part of that overall coverage, that's the only place where we see this kind of imagery and references being used so widely, and I think that this really speaks to the reason why we do have to address this issue and continue to chip away at it and get an acknowledgement of the damage that's done. The story about this young man who's a football player who's experiencing that on his own team the damage that's been done as a result of this imagery, from an educational perspective, just cannot be supported. But I think that because it's happening in the quote unquote fun and games part of society, somehow it gives us permission to engage in racist activity and then act like it's not there. And this is precisely the reason why we really have to address it.
This has, I think, been a very important conversation, which we're going to come back to. And I want to thank our guests today. This has been a fascinating conversation. The voice you just heard, Suzanne Schoen Harjo, who is president of the Morningstar Institute, National Native Rights Organization, columnist of the Indian Country Today Media Network, a past executive director of the National Congress of American Indians, founder of the National Museum of the American Indian, and former news director of the American Indian Press Association, Mark Trahant, an independent print and broadcast journalist who joined us many times here on Beyond the Spin, Ellen Starowski, who is professor in the Department of Sports Management at the Goodwin School of Professional Studies at Drexel University, and Marge Kalama, who is host of the show Talking Drum and Our People of Mother Earth on KWSO in Warm Springs, Oregon. It was a great discussion. I appreciate you all taking the time. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Montronis. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. To hear the show again and podcast any of our past shows and find out information about our guests, the work they do, what they've been writing, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcasts on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.